This podcast is brought to you by Podcast Nation.
Anyone else feel like a business class required in your schooling curriculum would have been massively helpful? Because same. We went to school to become therapists, and here we are 10 years later, really noticing the void in our knowledge on the business side of therapy, which is why we love our Masterclass membership. Masterclass has truly increased our confidence in running our therapy practice, The Therapy Group. Pros like Chris Voss, Robin Roberts, Daniel Pink, and Mark Cuban have filled that void and taught us so much about decision-making, negotiating, maximizing our time, and effective communication. This year, you too can learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Don't just talk about improving, Masterclass actually helps you do it. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/shrinkchicks. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/shrinkchicks. masterclass.com/shrinkchicks.
Welcome back to another episode of Shrink Chicks.
Take a seat on our virtual therapy couch and get ready to learn all about, well, you.
I'm Emily Beerley.
And I'm Jennifer Chaikin.
And we're both licensed marriage and family therapists and relationship experts. We're the owners and founders of The Therapy Group, a nationwide psychotherapy practice with down-to-earth therapists just like us.
Your session is starting, so get ready to know yourself and grow yourself. Hey, Em.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
You know what? Just living the dream, baby.
Aren't we all?
There's an eclipse today, the day we're recording. Here.
How funny is that? You know, I was thinking about the fact that we were definitely going to talk about the eclipse today, and then everyone is going to know how behind we are on recording. So we're like, wow.
Remember when we used to be really organized in a bulk record?
Yeah, that was fun.
And now poor Nikki has to live, like, the turnaround time is like 25 minutes.
So sorry, everyone. We're really sorry. We're going to be on top of it one day.
But you know what's funny is, like, there's been times where we've been on, like, really big celebrity podcasts, and they ask it, and then they're like, oh, can the girls come on, like, tomorrow at 2 o'clock? And we're like, okay, we'll make it work. And then the episode comes out 25 minutes later, and we're like, Jesus Christ, they leave shit to the last minute. That's us now.
That is us.
We're just disorganized.
We are. We just, you know, and maybe this is just who we are now.
We're just going to have to embrace it.
We have to embrace it. And that's the narrative that we're going to tell ourselves about.
Or the narrative that we tell ourselves is that you're only together if you do shit like a week in advance.
Yes.
But there's nothing wrong.
And so that means we must be disorganized because we're not doing shit.
Yeah.
More than a week in advance.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So obviously we're talking about narrative therapy today. However, we do have a listener question. And the question is, what is one piece of advice you would give to your younger version of yourself, from Jordan? What an amazing question. What do you think?
Okay, there's like, I don't know if it's like Helen Mirren or someone has a quote that says, like, I wish I told more people to fuck off.
Yeah.
That the piece of advice that I would give myself is you have to care so much less than you do. None of this shit matters.
Yeah.
And these things that feel earth-shattering and soul-breaking are, they don't matter in 20 years from now.
Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah, I don't know who says that quote, but it's my favorite quote. All I wish was that I told more people to fuck off.
Do you think that we need to go through it being earth-shattering in order for our brains to understand that it's not? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, part is like the exposure therapy of something, right? So, like, yes, the first few times it happens, it's so horrible, it's so scary, and then it doesn't. But I do think, for me, I am someone who just cared so much about what people think to an extreme. So I think there could be some truth to that. But in my situation, I could have just fucking told more people to fuck off.
And I think, and it comes with age too, right? It's just like caring less.
Yes. I feel like that's, like, you know, and everyone said, I mean, this is one of the reasons I'm, like, really excited for my 40s. Everyone says, I was, like, with my good friend Holly yesterday. She's in her mid-40s. And she was like, Holly's going to listen to this and be like, it's not mid-40s. It's early 40s. she's like, dude, like, your 40s are just amazing. And I was like, well, I already feel that in my mid-30s. And she's like, no. It's even way better. She's like, you truly don't give a fuck.
Yeah, it's like we don't even know what that is going to feel like yet. You know, we think we're comparing it to, like, a younger version of ourselves that, like, cared way more.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then when you get to your like 80s.
Yeah. You must really not give a shit.
You really don't give a shit at that point.
I feel like my mom, I mean, my mom is 77 now and she's like, I don't give a shit about anything.
Exactly. So like kind of cool. Can't wait to get there.
Yeah, right? What about you?
You know, I was thinking about that. What advice would I give to my younger self? Invest. Invest all your money.
Buy Bitcoin.
Buy Bitcoin, right? Right? Like if I could actually give myself like financial advice.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, yeah. Don't spend that money on a wedding.
Yeah. Like invest it in something.
Yes. You do not know. Nobody needs to spend that money on a wedding. That's what I realized. I tell everyone now, anytime someone's like wedding planning, I'm like, have you considered eloping?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm so rude. I'm like, have you considered not doing this?
But you know, at the time, you know, because that, you know, felt like an option too, right? Like, but you want the wedding so bad.
I know.
And I think it goes by. It flies by.
Eloping was as normalized pre-COVID as it is now. Like, I feel like COVID really made like micro weddings and elopements like way bigger. And I'm like, I love this trend.
Me too. I love a micro wedding.
Yes. I think micro weddings are the coolest fucking things ever. But you even had the wherewithal to like not have a bachelorette, not have a bridal shower.
Also, I saw you go through that.
A bachelorette?
Bachelorette. I was like, nope, not for me. Thank God you were a child bride.
Thank God I was a child bride and I did everything before everyone. Oh my God, I made a joke about being a teen mom. I had my daughter at 29 and I call myself a teen mom, which now I'm like, maybe this is disrespectful to teen moms and I apologize if it is. the girl makes bad jokes sometimes. And I made that joke yesterday at a party and this mom like quickly did the math. She's like, you weren't a teen mom. I was like, I was fucking kidding. She was like, wait,
actually
what?
Actually a teen mom?
No, she had her kids in her late 30s.
She was like doing the quick math.
Yeah, she was. She was like, wait, no, you weren't. I was like, oh, my God, what?
Just felt like that compared to comparatively.
Exactly.
Which makes sense.
Yes. So we have narratives about ourselves that people feel a certain way, that we have to do a certain thing. And we're going to talk a little bit about narratives we hold about ourselves today.
So narrative therapy is a legitimate form of therapy that therapists use.
But it's one of the newer ones. It's from the 1980s. It's Michael White and David Epstein. And like that actually, you have to understand, is like that is actually kind of new age for the therapy.
Yes, it is.
Something from the 1980s is actually considered like still relatively novel.
Yes. And you know what? I think narrative therapy, learning narrative therapy is one of the therapies that at least I learned that like really transformed how I saw myself. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, because I think it stuck with me so much, it like continues to transform. It allows me to question narratives I have about myself like all the time. So that's why, you know, we don't love gatekeeping. We want to share this with you. You can be your own therapist. Actually, probably not. But no,
but you can. But this is the shit that's really helpful in between your sessions, right?
Yes.
We're going to use today in today's session, in today's episode, which is like a session, let's use the framework of insight, awareness, action for some of this stuff. So keep that in mind that we start to talk about these things. We want you to consider insight. That's what we're going to give you today. And then after this episode, we want you to take the awareness and the action moving on here from today.
There are four principles of narrative therapy that I think are really important to kind of set the stage for our conversation. The first one being that reality is socially constructed, which means that our interactions and dialogue with others impacts the way that we experience our reality. The second one, reality is influenced by and communicated through language, which is something that actually suggests that people who speak different languages may have a radically different interpretation of the same experiences. Number three is having a narrative that can be understood helps us organize and maintain our own reality. And so in other words, the stories and narratives help us to make sense of our experiences. And then number four, this one is kind of like blows people's minds a lot when you can really grasp this, that there is no objective reality or absolute truth. What is true for many of us may not be the same for another person. or even for ourselves at another point in time.
You know what I love? I feel like we talked about this a little bit in our episode with Nedra. Nedra gave this amazing example that, like, you know, you'll see a you'll see like a news article, and it's like, you know, this someone kept hostages of children in their house, and then they like interview the next door neighbor, and the next door neighbor is like, oh, it's crazy. He was always nice. He helped me with my trash cans. So like, the thing is that like, those girls' reality is like, this is such an evil piece of shit, of course, because they are. And then the next door neighbor was like, I don't know, they help with my trash can sometimes, right? So like, this idea that we have is not absolute. And it still, and it once again goes with the story we have about ourselves.
Yeah.
So the story I have about myself is that everyone leaves me out, or no one likes me, or I'm always alone, no one shows up for me. That is not true. So a great way to start to identify the narratives you hold is look at absolute language that you use. Always, never, stuff like that.
Yes. Yeah. So these dominant stories, like those stories that we tell ourselves about who we are, they are stories that shape our identity. It shapes the way in which we see ourselves. And the thing is that we just like walk around life without recognizing that like this was something that was constructed. How was it constructed? There are multiple ways that that has been constructed for you. And so when we were developing our own identities, we were looking to adults. We were looking at our experiences. We were to say, who am I? Right. And so sometimes adults in our life would say, oh, you know, you can't do, they would project their own narratives of who they are onto us. And then we internalize those narratives about who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, then we grow up, we become adults that carry those narratives around with us without realizing that there's something that has been constructed for us and then we have constructed for ourselves.
Yeah.
So the reason why I say that is because just to recognize that the ideas that you have about yourself is something that can be deconstructed.
Mm.
It can be something that can be changed. If you can look at it and say, well, is this true? Let me look at all of the ways in which this might not be true of me.
Yeah.
If you listen to one of our latest episodes titled Em and Jen Fall Apart, you know the current feelings of burnout that we're both facing. Running our business, the therapy group, keeping up with the podcast, and enduring a house renovation leaves little time for grocery shopping, meal prepping, and cooking. So we are extremely thankful for our sponsor, Hungry Root. When I received my first delivery of the Hungry Root box, it felt like a breath of fresh air. Hungry Root saves me so much time and offers customizable options. Plus, with perfectly portioned ingredients, I'm wasting far less food than I would if I were left to my own devices in the kitchen. No more throwing away wilted veggies or expired condiments lurking in the back of my fridge. Each order is fully customizable, so you can take their suggestions or choose anything you want. They've got fresh produce, high quality meat and seafood, smoothies, sweets, ready to eat meals, kids snacks and meals, vitamins and supplements, and much more. I discovered Three Little Pigs, spinach, feta, and egg bites in my last delivery, and they are my new obsession. Also, Hungry Root's coconut curry sauce is not to be missed. Everything from Hungry Root follows a simple standard. It's got to taste good, be quick to make, and contain whole trusted ingredients. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Shrink Chicks listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/shrinkchicks to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/shrinkchicks. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. Can you believe we're on year 5 of Shrink Chicks? We have been podcasting since 2019 and have somehow yet to change the photo of us on the cover of the podcast. We are planning a photo shoot in a few weeks so we can finally update our cover art. We both obviously need new outfits for the photo shoot, but really didn't want to break the bank. So thank goodness for Quince, where we can get multiple high-quality outfits for a very reasonable price. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach. For the shoot, we want to go with a few different looks, one being monochrome, so I opted for a few key items from Quince's collection, including their Mongolian cashmere tee, classic trouser pant, and structured blazer. I couldn't resist adding their timeless 14-karat gold jewelry pieces to complete my look, because who doesn't love accessorizing? The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes, making me feel even better about my purchases. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/shrinkchicks for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/shrinkchicks to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/shrinkchicks.
Okay, can we go into some listener questions to to shape the narrative of the rest of this conversation?
Yes.
How can we identify the narratives we've constructed about ourselves? So with this, once again, I want you to really think about the absolutes of language that you use. If you say to yourself, everyone always leaves me, nothing works out for me, it doesn't matter, what's the point, right? And so there is no chance in hell that's 100% true. Most things in life are not 100% fucking true, besides that we're awesome. And
100% true.
100% true. So for the someone whose narrative is like, I hate those girls, right? And here's the thing. So some people listening to this podcast might think like, wow, Emily and Jenna have been really helpful. We have clients to thank Emily and Jenna really helpful. Now, there may be clients that came into our office at one point that, let's say we were having an off day. Let's say we didn't meet them where we're at. Let's say that we didn't understand them as people. And they walked out and said, that was the worst fucking therapist I've ever been to.
Right.
Does their story mean that that is my story now?
Right.
No. That's what you mean about it's subjective, everything.
Yes. And so, you know, I think that one of the, you were talking about, talking to yourself in absolutes, how we say these absolutes and then we hold on to those narratives. And then I think what happens is that we have this narrative about who we are, and then that narrative shapes our behavior. Mm. So one of the things that you said, Em, is I have this idea, everyone always leaves me. Because I've developed this narrative about how I see the world.
We're laughing because this is me.
Yeah.
This is my narrative that we have to work with a lot within this business.
Then how does it shape my behavior, right? What do I do then if I have this narrative of everyone always leaves me?
And so one of those might mean is that for me, if someone like my business partner goes on a vacation, I might get very anxious about this.
Because it then reinforces that narrative.
Now, and also let's say my husband travels, right?
Yeah.
All of these, my dad traveled my entire fucking life 5 days a week. I have I have such severe abandonment wounds, but my fear is that people will never come back.
Right.
So what will happen is Jen will go on vacation. She will love her life in fucking, I don't even remember where the fuck you're going next. Florida.
Right. Florida for a few days.
And she never comes back. And then I have to run this business by myself. I don't know how to get out. I'm trapped. I suffocate, right? Like that is where my anxiety goes. Now, here's the issue that happens is you start to then develop a self-fulfilling prophecy where you start to be so fucking annoying that somebody does want to leave you. I'm not, but I'm saying that. But that would happen to me in the past, right?
Yeah.
Like, so the way that this would show up before I did so much of my work, specifically when I was in college and also drinking, I would be so fucking anxious. I would be at a party. I would show up, right? So me and I was in a sorority. My husband was in a frat, and I'm embarrassed to admit all this. Okay. So I'm in a sorority. You like have like mixers with other frats, and then you like all end up at the same party together. It's so crazy. And so you'd like go from this mixer where I'm totally talking to people, flirting, doing whatever, meet up with my partner at a party. And I'm like fucking anxious as fuck because he's talking to other people because I'm so deeply insecure about being left. Then what do I do? I'm a big old bitch. And I don't do that because I want him to leave. I do that because that is the self-protective mechanism that I do that actually then recreates my narrative.
Yeah.
It typically does not work out.
Yeah.
For you. Somebody had this really great question about, this person said, I know from therapy, good job, that my role serves as a function, but how do I tell if it's teetering on dysfunction? So understanding the function is a huge part of understanding ourselves. What you have to, and then when we talk about this idea of like moving on from insight, awareness, action, so you got the insight from therapy, then maybe you are sitting there and you have the awareness like, wow, I am getting upset with my partner right now for traveling and I'm being very anxious. And when I get anxious, I get critical and controlling. The action that has to happen is, where's my vulnerability with my relationship, right? Hey, this is my narrative about everyone leaving. I know that I'm doing it. I'm feeling really, really scared and overwhelmed. Can we talk through this process?
Yeah.
And how do I recreate my narrative or find what's also called a sparkling event in narrative therapy, which is find the exception. Like every single time my partner's gone on a business trip, they've come home. Every single time Jen has gone on a trip, she's come back. And so you have to then keep identifying the sparkling events that happen to reality check your narrative, because your narrative is never 100% true.
Yeah. And your narrative, right? So if you look at the narrative of like, it's there to attempt to protect you in some way, right? So like if in that narrative of like, this person's never going to come back, then my anxiety comes up, then that anxiety can then protect you. It can take care of you, right? It's this idea of like, okay, if no one ever comes back, then I have to take care of this myself. I'm going to take care of this. I can handle this. Like the anxiety is like pushing you into some sort of action. Yeah. And at the same time, then you realize as an adult, maybe it's not helping me in the same way. And so I love that idea of like understanding the narrative behind it and then how, like what the self-protective mechanism is.
Yeah.
And then once you recognize, is this self-protective mechanism, is it actually helping me? And if not, what do I want to do differently?
Mm. I mean, the action's always the hardest part, right?
Yes. It is, because if your narratives are so ingrained, right? Like they're so embedded in us.
And you know, and so when I talk about this idea of like awareness, often awareness doesn't come until afterwards. And that is okay. If your awareness doesn't happen until afterwards of like, wow, I was just really upset about this thing. Here's what happened for me. You get to go back to people and say, hey, I want to address what happened last week.
Yeah.
I want to address what was going on for me in that moment.
Yeah.
And I think we put so much pressure on ourselves to have like the insight and the awareness in the moment. But like for most of us, like it's not there. And that is like totally okay.
Yeah.
What we want to do is, how do we take that? Because the more you identify it afterwards, then eventually you will be able to talk yourself through it.
So someone said, how do you challenge your narrative constructively and not negatively? One of the incredible things about narrative therapy is externalizing the problem, to understand that you are not the problem, that the problem is the problem,
mm-hmm.
right? To go from this idea of, oh, you know, I get so anxious in relationships, to when I'm in a relationship, anxiety, I don't know, hovers around, anxiety is around, right? So you're like externalizing and personifying the problem in a way.
So then I give it a character, right? So let's say I'm in a relationship, and when I'm in a relationship, anxious Annie comes out. And anxious Annie is my nice little friend in the room here. And anxious Annie, and this, you've heard us talk about this as well with IFS in terms of managers. Don't forget, all theories are kind of based off each other. Okay, guys.
All right. Mixed.
So anxious Annie comes in the room and she's like, whoa, girl. Jen is going on vacation. She's definitely not coming back. So you have to prep yourself right now for this situation, okay? And Annie is like, she is my girl in that moment. Like, she has my fucking back. She's warning me. She's there to manage. She's there to protect me. And she does all this great stuff. Here's the issue. Anxious Annie doesn't know what the fuck she's talking about. She's actually not helping. She's that friend that's like stirring up bullshit. You know, like that girl in high school that was like, hey, do you know, like what? She's like the girl
stirring the pot.
In the 90s when people would do three-way phone calls.
Yes, that was in Mean Girls.
That's what Anxious Annie does. She's like, all right, we're gonna
Did that ever happen to you?
Okay, I have a really traumatizing story.
You don't have to bring, you don't have to talk about it if you don't want to.
No, this is hilarious. Okay. It's not hilarious. At the time, it wasn't hilarious, but looking back, you're like, oh my fucking God, kids are horrible.
Yeah.
So I went to a private elementary school that ended at fifth grade. It is where my daughter goes now, and like, it's already bringing up my shit. Okay. So I had a wonderful experience in elementary school. The issue is that you then get to sixth grade and you're like, I got to start over somewhere. I don't know any of these people. So my parents put me in this other school, which ironically is 3 minutes away from my house. And it was just a shit show from the beginning. All these kids have been to school since kindergarten. I came in, you know, most people didn't fucking like me. I think it was a lot of threatening, weird, insecurity, blah, blah, blah. Also being in middle school is the fucking worst.
The worst.
So the one day these kids were, I don't know what happened. They like, I can't remember. Something happened that, like, whatever reason, I got hurt. People were bullying me. Who the fuck knows? And the one kid who was the ringleader of it called me that night to apologize. And he's like, I'm really sorry. That was really shitty. And I'm like, thanks so much. I'm like crying. My mom's there. And then it turns out there's a bunch of people on the fucking phone. He goes, just fucking kidding. And then they hang up. I could tell you exactly where I was sitting. I can tell you exactly what I was wearing. I can tell you exactly his fucking name, which I will not do on this podcast.
Oh, and, my God.
And there was a bunch of people on the phone. I never went back to school. I dropped out. I switched schools the next day and never went back.
I think people underestimate like how traumatic those experiences can be.
I mean, we talk so much about like how our families affect us. And we should probably talk a little bit more about how social relationships and friendships or non-friendships affect us in childhood, because that shit'll fuck you up.
Completely. And if you think about, like, we're talking about narratives and like the narratives we develop, like your social relationships are so important during those times to you and your identity development. And so to be having those experiences, which I think everyone does in different ways. I mean, that one's pretty fucked up.
Yeah, bad, right? Isn't it funny that it was from a guy too? People talk shit about girls, but men are cool. Middle school, no matter what, is cruel.
Yeah, off air, you tell me who that is.
I will tell you who it is. We won't blast somebody this podcast.
I'm going to hunt them down. Anyone else go through soap and cleaning products insanely quick? At both my house and at our business, we're constantly replacing plastic bottles. Did you know that an estimated 5 billion plastic hand soap and cleaning bottles are thrown away each year? And if that's not bad enough, most cleaning formulas are 90% water, which is heavy to ship, leading to excessive carbon emissions. That's why we are thrilled to introduce our newest sponsor, Blue Land. Blue Land is on a mission to eliminate single-use plastic by reinventing cleaning essentials to be better for you and the planet with the same powerful clean you're used to. The idea is simple. They offer refillable cleaning products with a beautifully cohesive design that looks great on your counter. Fill your reusable bottles with water, drop in the tablets, and wait for them to dissolve. You will never have to grab bulky cleaning supplies on your grocery run. Refills start at just $2.25. You can even set up a subscription or buy in bulk for an additional savings. From cleaning sprays to hand soap, toilet bowl cleaner, and laundry tablets, all Blue Land products are made with clean ingredients you can feel good about. And I'll be honest, I was a bit skeptical at first. Can eco-friendly products really tackle tough messes? Well, Blue Land proved me wrong. The products I received, like their multi-service cleaner and bathroom cleaner, were powerful. Grime, grease, and dirt don't stand a chance. Blue Land is not only good for the planet, but also for your wallet. And the starter kit I received was beautifully packed. The bottles are sleek and sturdy, and the scents are amazing. Lemongrass, lavender eucalyptus, and fresh lemon, or you can choose fragrance-free. Blue Land has a special offer for listeners. Right now, get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/shrinkchicks. You won't want to miss this. blueland.com/shrinkchicks for 15% off. That's blueland.com/shrinkchicks to get 15% off.
But the other thing is, right, so then you have this narrative, nobody actually likes me. And then it gets confirmed, right? Did this person actually confirm my entire fucking narrative? No, but in my mind, they did.
Right.
And this becomes a huge problem because then after that, I'm not able to actually trust people. You're not actually able to let people in, because if the narrative is nobody actually likes me, how can I trust someone and open up to them? So then you go and try to make relationships, and you switch schools, you try to make relationships, and I'm not very nice because I don't really fucking trust.
Your protective mechanisms, because every wall is up,
right? I just had this horrific experience. It's a shit show. And it turned into this whole thing. It was at a private school that my parents tried to like sue them for the tuition. It was like this entire thing that it turns into. I end up in this other school, and I like totally, I want you to know that I showed up to my first day of public school wearing a Avril Lavigne essentially wannabe outfit. I was in hot pink UFO pants.
Cool.
A short sleeve shirt from Hot Topic.
Yes.
A tie around my neck.
Cool.
I had on 1,000,000 rubber bracelets with spikes on them. And I could not imagine an outfit that better said, fuck off and get away from me. I can't trust you.
Can I tell you, that is the type of outfit I always wanted to wear.
But because you always wanted to be goth. I did.
I did.
I rocked a serious, serious goth stage for about 2 years.
Did you have like a pointy like belt? Like a spiky belt?
Yes, of course. Of course.
Cool.
Everything. And I only shopped at Hot Topic.
The vest.
I just had 1,000,000 different colors of UFO pants. Do you remember what UFOs were?
No. What are they?
Google it after this.
Okay. I would Google it right now. Can you imagine if we were friends during that time?
We wouldn't have been, because I wouldn't have let you be my friend, because I was too busy being mean to people, because I was too scared to let people near me.
I don't know. I was such a people pleaser. Oh, I probably would have been nice.
I will say the interesting thing about showing up totally goth into seventh grade is you don't go unnoticed.
Yeah.
So the one thing I didn't think to do was fly under the radar. That didn't happen.
So did that, not to keep taking you into your trauma, but like, did that, like you dressing in that way, like what did that do in your relationships at the new school? Like, did you eventually open up?
I mean, I was wearing Hollister by 2 years later, right? I was done with that pretty quickly. But I will say the one thing it did is it was almost like wearing a costume that made me feel strong.
Mm.
And that was the survival of it, right? So it might not have really protected me, but a placebo affected.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so because I walked in and I was almost like acting and wearing a costume, it made me feel really brave.
Yeah.
And I thought, right. And that was like my one way of how I was going to handle stuff. Wasn't necessarily healthy. Listen, it kind of worked out. I only rocked that way for about 2 years. You know, 2 years later, I'm wearing freaking Hollister and Abercrombie and like hanging out with people and making friends. But it was like I needed to be someone else.
Which, you know, even saying like, was that necessarily healthy? I feel like you coped with it in a way that was like really helpful for you.
Yeah. I mean, I was also cutting a lot at this time.
All right. Maybe there's
self-injurious behavior, maybe.
Right. There's the caveat to that. Right.
The caveat here was the self-injurious behavior.
Right, so maybe.
And the very, very bad obsession with the movie 13. Okay.
Right. Oh, God. I loved 13.
Yeah. And that's why you're a therapist.
Yes.
But, right. But the narrative was that no one's ever going to like me. Everyone's going to leave. Whatever. This is the whole thing. And I maybe had that happen for a few years because I was a big part of not letting people in.
Mm.
But then it wasn't real.
Right.
So I think that's the thing is like, even if you go with your narrative for a while, at any point you get to turn around and do something different.
Yeah.
And I did this in college too, when Aaron and I were struggling a little bit, where I became a real big bitch my senior year.
So as a way to protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
See, mine goes the complete opposite way. Big shocker. Shocker of the century. Mine is like, I'm going to turn inwards and not talk to anyone.
Yeah.
You know,
I can't do that.
Yeah. We're just like, I mean, that's why it works.
That's why it works, right?
Well, I was just going to say, just to go off of like that story, which I think is like so helpful and relatable in a lot of ways. Like, if you're listening to this and you start to understand, like, well, then what are the narratives that I developed? And, like, look at your own childhood growing up, whether it's from parents, whether it's from friends, whether it's, you know, from your different experiences. And look at those narratives and how have you brought them into, you know, your identity today to help you be able to question it. And when you're holding on to them within your identity, how does that then affect your behaviors as an adult? Just like take the time to think about that and write that down. Mm-hmm. And then ask yourself, are those behaviors helping me? Are they serving me? Are they reinforcing this unhelpful narrative that I have about myself? And is it keeping me from vulnerable connection with other people, keeping me from getting my needs met in different ways in relationships?
Quite a few people asked about narratives about ourselves versus narratives other people have about us. What are your thoughts on that?
My first thought is other people's narratives about who you are. My question would be, how is that affecting you? Right? What about that's important to you? And I say that not that like it shouldn't be important, because obviously our interactions with other people affect us. But my question is, like, is it based, is your idea about other people see you actually based in your idea about how you see yourself? Are people actually reacting to you in this way? Are they responding to you in this way? Or is it this projected idea of people think this about me? What evidence do you have that people think this about you? Because we don't have the longer question, or, you know, this isn't a Dear Em and Jen, that we don't have that information. And I'm not saying it's not true that maybe other people do have this idea about you. Maybe they developed this narrative based on an old version of you, right? An old protective mechanism that you were using. And I think that's something that, you know, you and I have talked about, is like growing out of an old version of yourself. Like, people see you in this one way. And how when you start to grow into a different person, they're still holding on to this like narrative that they have about you. You know, me and you get this a lot. Well, they'll be like, I can't believe that you run a business, or that you, right? Like, there's this kind of like narrative about, because, you know, when your family sees you growing up, you're younger, you're like still figuring out your footing. And so I think that the narrative that sometimes other people hold about us is very different than like the narratives that we've been able to develop about who we are because of like what we've been through and like running this business. But you and I hear all the time, like, I can't believe you're doing that, right? I never expected you to do something like that, right? We've gotten that so many times.
Yes.
And so I think that sometimes people hold on to an old version of you that in their minds doesn't necessarily allow you to grow, even though you have grown tremendously for yourself. And so my question would be, how are those old narratives that other people are holding, how is it affecting you? Mm-hmm. You know, can you understand that that's just because they haven't been able to see the growth that you've had? Are you taking it personally? Is it affecting the narrative that you hold about yourself? To be able to separate out other people's narratives about you and your own narrative about yourself, I think, is the most important thing there.
Let's go with this one. I feel so uncomfortable when trying to shift out of my peacekeeper role in my family of origin. Tips for sitting with the discomfort of what it means to not be the peacekeeper for once, right? So this person is talking about, there's a narrative of who I have to be in my family. I have to be the one that anchors everyone down. I have to be the peacekeeper for the family, okay? So they're saying that they feel so fucking uncomfortable when they try to not do this role that they think is built into their narrative. It's going to be really uncomfortable. When we talk about learning distress tolerance skills, that's what this is about. So distress tolerance skills is, how much distress can I actually tolerate and regulate and keep my nervous system going? So what that might look like is going outside and walking, bilateral stimulation, listening to music, calling friends or not calling people if you need to do the opposite of what your anxiety says, reading, drawing, arithmetic, just kidding, right? Like, getting a fucking hobby. There's a million things to do, and you're going to have to try out a million and one of them to find out what works for you. Just because journaling works for Betty Sue does not mean it works for you. And if it does work for you, and that's awesome, that doesn't mean every other person it works for and that you should push it on them. So the tips for sitting is, I want you to try as many coping skills as possible when you're not activated. If you just try to incorporate the coping skills when your nervous system is already activated, you're not going to be able to do it the same way. We have to practice for the big game before we get there.
Practice makes perfect.
Practice makes perfect.
I would also say, like, what does being, I wonder if being the peacekeeper is embedded into this person's identity, right? Like, do you get praise for being the peacekeeper? Like, what do you get from being the peacekeeper?
Mm-hmm.
Because to be able to, like, what you're saying is, like, you're about to make, like, an identity shift to not be the peacekeeper, which is another reason why it's so uncomfortable. So I would also say, like, who are you outside of being the peacekeeper? How do you develop and understand yourself, understand your identity as who you are as a person that isn't about taking care of other people? It isn't about being triangulated into relationships. Because what it means is you're going to have to build up a new identity. You're going to have to feel good about doing other things, things for yourself, taking care of yourself, nurturing your relationships in a way that doesn't mean just being the peacekeeper and being there for other people. So what does your identity look like outside of being that peacekeeper?
Are you ready for Dear Imogen?
I'm ready. How time flies.
Dear Imogen. Hi, Imogen. I want to start out by saying your podcast is absolutely life-changing. Oh, I found it while trying to find advice and research more about becoming a therapist, but I find my new favorite podcast at the same time. I wanted to reach out because I feel so lost and overwhelmed and where to even begin, and was hoping to get advice from someone I have respected and admiration for. I'm 29, a full-time working mom of a 2.5-year-old, and now feel called to go back to school to become a therapist and specialize in postpartum depression and anxiety, as well as anxiety in general. I would need to go online due to my current situation, but worry that online degrees in counseling aren't as legit or respected as going in person. I have heard of people having trouble getting a job because they went online and it wasn't a very well-known college. I have always had a love of mental health and strive to help others destigmatize it and know that they aren't alone. I went through trauma, depression, anxiety, as well as a difficult postpartum experience and couldn't give enough appreciation to the people I was able to seek help from and who guided me to get to the place I am today. I strongly want to be that support and safe place for someone else, which inspires the drive to become a therapist. I was hoping to get some guidance and advice from you girls on what the next best step would be. Thank you so much. What do you think? We hire a ton of people. What do you think?
I think what matters more is the internship.
Yes, same. I'm going to be honest. We barely look at colleges.
Yeah.
Barely look at the university.
We want to know.
Internship matters.
Internship matters. We want to know what your actual experience was in your internship, because that's where you're doing the real work.
Yeah.
You also learn so much after grad school, and you have the opportunity to learn so much after grad school.
Yeah.
So, you know, on top of grad, and I know when, if you're like just entering into or thinking about going to grad school, like hearing that is very overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in a way it can also be empowering of like, you want to specialize in something very specific and you can get so much education around that even after grad school.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we are hiring people, we look for someone who has done a lot of work in their internship, someone who had great supervisors, someone who has a genuine passion and, you know, drive to do what they do and like really, really cares about people.
Yeah.
That's so important for us to see that, like, you know, just as you're talking through this, Dear Em and Jen, it seems like you care so much about what you want to do. Like, that is something that can't be taught.
Yeah.
It's something that can't be quantified. And so if you're trying to join a practice that cares about the schooling, like maybe they're going to care.
Yeah.
But not every practice is going to care specifically about the schooling. They're going to care about your internship, the passion that you have, your personality, how much you care about people, like how much work you've done within yourself. Those are the things that we really look for. And everywhere is different. So I wouldn't put a blanket statement on it.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
I would say this. When we look at resumes, we have hired plenty of people that came from virtual programs.
Yeah.
No problem whatsoever. Their internship is the number one thing we are looking for. And then in the interview, what we're looking for is you to tell us about your therapeutic journey.
Yeah.
What we want to fucking know is that, are you also practicing what you preach? We've had people in first interviews say like, oh, and I'm thinking about going to my own therapy. Then we're like, yeah, we're not going to see you for a second interview.
Right. Right.
But for us now, I mean, rarely do we look at schools. Now, if it was a very religious school, because we're a secular practice, it would probably sway us in some way, right? But like, that's the only thing that I could imagine. But like, for us, like, yeah, man, like, that's fine if you go to virtual community college. Doesn't fucking matter. We're not looking at that at all. But we probably are looking only, like, mainly for the internship. And for us, because we're a group private practice, we would want someone who had a little experience doing that. But that's not always. We have lots of folks that didn't have that experience that come on in. But if what works for you to fulfill your dreams is to go virtual, fucking go virtual.
Yeah.
We have half our interns right now are from virtual programs.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also think we want to look at like the way you think about things.
Yeah.
Like that's really important, is like the way that you conceptualize and think about things. And that isn't based in like whether you're doing a virtual program or doing an in-person program. Yeah. So I really think that those things are the most important. And that's what we look at. That doesn't mean every practice is going to look at the same thing. But absolutely, if a virtual program is what works for you and it's the only barrier to you living your dream is whether you're going in person or virtual, go virtual.
Well, especially as and also don't forget, put being a mom on your resume. That is such an important thing. And you should be with your baby, with your kid, and have flexibility and do your virtual program 100%. I would also say if somebody has strong feelings about virtual programs, it probably speaks a little bit more about their, you know, elitism than it does about you.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Narratives. The narratives they hold.
The narrative they hold about virtual programs, which are often fucking amazing.
Right.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode of Shrink Chicks.
We'll see you back here next Monday for another session.
In the meantime, if you want a question answered or a topic discussed, follow us on Instagram at Shrink Chicks. And if you're looking to get connected with a therapist like us to start or continue your therapeutic journey, visit thetherapygroup.com. Just fill out a contact form on our website and we will personally match you with one of our amazing therapists.
Also, if you'd be so kind, we'd love a rating review and for you to share with a friend or an enemy or a mother-in-law. Honestly, whoever needs it, so that we can keep reaching more people on our mission to bring mental health topics to your ears every week.
Thanks for being here with us. And don't forget, to grow yourself, you gotta know yourself.